humorous hacks. It's a medical podcast. We're gonna teach you. We're gonna teach you things.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Humorous Hacks. We have a special guest star this week who very confusingly is also called Sarah.
Slash very awesomely.
Very awesomely. So, hello, Dr. Sarah Hoskins. Would you like to say hello?
Hi, guys.
She's here. So, we're totally fangirling. Let's give it a bit of a background about how we came across Dr. Sarah Hoskins. So last year, and this is Karen talking right now, I was on my pediatric...
Why do you have to point out that it's you?
Because my name isn't Sarah and your
but
name is
Sarah. But everyone knows who you are and what you sound like.
Do you think they do?
You're very distinctive.
I hope so. Infiltrating your voice.
It's true. When I listen, I can tell the difference between you two.
That's so nice.
I love the podcast, by the way.
We love you.
We love you so much.
So Sarah was both of our residents.
Yeah.
This last year and this year.
Yeah. And so I had Sarah last year and she literally taught me every single thing I knew about pediatrics times a bajillion and it was the best thing ever. And then Sarah was on a peds rotation this year and sent me a message being like, oh my God, I have the best resident ever and we have the same name and we call each other L1 and L2.
Not L1 and L1-2. You got it wrong. Okay. Right out the gate, you got it wrong. S1 and S2.
I am loving the
two.
Sense.
The heart sound. Heart sound 1, heart sound 2. S1, S2, lub dub.
What's L1 and L2?
I don't know.
Spine, guys.
God, I love having a real doctor here. They're like, ah, I know, guys. Don't worry. I have a degree. We're like, what do you mean? Anyway, and I was like, holy shit, is that Sarah Hoskins? And it was so exciting. And it was a perfect moment of harmony. So, and now we have Sarah Hoskins on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Sarah Husking is S1 because she's the big boss and I'm S2 because I'm the lowly medical student.
And as I told Sarah, there is no such thing as a lowly medical student. There are valued colleagues because Sarah particularly and many medical students I've worked with are awesome and so helpful. So helpful. It makes such a difference, guys. Keep doing the good work. We know you're not paid, but it makes a difference.
This is like when we need that Snapchat filter when it makes our eyes go really big and our hearts go from it and like a single tear runs down my cheek. Like, they like us. We're useful.
Yeah, so lub dub is better than S1, S2 because it's less hierarchical. So
exactly.
So which one of you are lub and which one's dub?
She's lub.
Okay, so
I'm dub.
Big boss, Dr. Sarah Hoskins, is lub. So lub. If you mind me talking you that, calling you that, what are you doing here today? What are you going to teach us about? Because we are fruitfully wanting to learn.
I think one of the things medical students, and certainly I have problems with, is neonatal jaundice. So it's something that's super common.
Yeah.
Super, super common. But, it's very often asked on exams, I would think. I certainly was asked about it on exams, and I don't know about you guys.
Probably. I wiped all those memories as soon as I stepped out of the exam. I had post-traumatic
I wish. I wish I had that. Anyway, no, so it's very common. You'll see it a lot in any, unless you're a completely adult doctor, but if you work in emergency, if you work in peds, if you work in ONG, if you work in as a GP, you're going to see children who come in and they're yellow and their parents are freaking out and they're like, why is my child yellow and looks like a pumpkin? And you need to be like, that's fine, or ooh, we got to do something about that. And so I thought I'd go through this.
Oh, that is interesting. I was actually a pumpkin as a baby because I was A, super chubby, and B, super jaundiced.
Were you?
And then I became a pumpkin, so it happened.
Delicious.
Did you have a glass slipper as well?
No, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Cinderella.
All right. Impart your wisdom, Sarah. Tell us everything.
Okay. So I thought the first thing that we could do to make neonatal jaundice, if you kind of understand it conceptually, it makes it easier to think about when you're actually looking at the patient about how what could cause it. So hopefully some of you remember how hemoglobin is broken down or how it's made and then broken down and how we get rid of it. So basically red blood cells are made in the bone marrow. They're then go through your circulation. Mm-hmm. At some point, they get chomped up by the spleen and the liver. I can't quite remember that. But they go to the liver.
Yeah.
Then the hemoglobin gets taken out. It gets transformed by magicalness into bilirubin.
Bilirubin.
Then comes out through the kidney and into the bile and into the duodenum and then comes out. So if you think about it like that, and then you think about, ah, so that's what happens in adults.
Just step back. Through the kidney?
Oh, no, you can think about the kidney, because if you get obstructive jaundice, that's why you get really dark urine and pale stool. Because if it's only going through the kidney, because it's obstructed, so it can't get into the bowel, that's why it all goes through the kidney. But most of the time, most of it comes through the bowel, and only a little bit comes through the kidney.
Oh, cool. I'm glad you described that, actually. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of jumping ahead, but that's what happens in adults.
Yeah.
But in babies, and especially newborn babies, how are they different? So...
aren't they just tiny little humans? Isn't that what pediatrics is?
Don't say that.
Yeah. They come to us in suits and they've got a cigar and they're like, fix me, doc.
Things are not to say.
Every pediatrician ever is like trying to stab you.
I know. Hashtag things not to say to pediatrician. Go on.
So pretty much what happens is they have babies, because they've just come from the womb, have...
yep.
all of this hemoglobin, and it's a different type of hemoglobin. It's hemoglobin F, and it's all changing pathways, and it's all, they've got lots and lots of it in their blood. So if you think about it, if you have more of it and then it has to break down,
yeah,
you're more likely to get jaundiced, because there is more of it in you to break down. So you more get more of the side effects or the byproducts, and that's why you get jaundice. And that's one of the reasons.
And so that's just, is that like the physiological jaundice? Is that just the no big deal?
Yeah.
So chill.
But it's also, so that's kind of physiological jaundice, which is, you know, 50% of newborn babies will have some sort of jaundice.
Like me.
And vast majority of that is physiological.
Right. Yeah, and you're normal. Yeah.
Because of these different processes. And so that was that's one of the reasons. So they basically have more red blood cells per kilo than adults do. The other thing is that you're changing types of hemoglobin. So the hemoglobin F breaks down faster than the hemoglobin A and B. So
hemoglobin F breaks down faster.
But red cells is also, lifespan is also shorter. So it's 70 days.
Guys,
how long is the red cell lifespan in adults?
120!
120!
Bing bing. Yes, as soon as ever.
I'm
so happy I knew that.
Such keenies.
So that's another reason. And then if you go to the liver, which is the next part of the pathway of the breaking down, basically the liver doesn't work because it's brand new. So well. So they have immature glucuronyl transferase. Yes.
Rightio.
So anyway, so in the liver, it's basically hasn't kind of caught up yet, and it's working slower, so they don't break down it as well. So that's one of the reasons.
Whoa.
And then the other thing is they have decreased gut motility and a sterile gut. So there's less conversion to stercobilurgin, which means that it builds up.
Whoa.
So all of those reasons mean that newborn babies and neonates are really likely to get jaundice. And then there are some babies who are even more likely to get jaundice.
Rightio. That makes a lot of sense. I think I was just like, oops, some people get jaundice. That just happens.
You know, it's funny. When you were talking about that, I was thinking about how we talked about icterus being Greek for yellow bird, and how like the stork could be like a yellow bird and bringing all these babies, but like lots of them are yellow and jaundice.
And that's actually probably how physiological systems work.
Maybe.
Pronunciation is not our strong point today. We'll continue.
Yes. So as a starting point, it's a good thing to think about. And then once you get into the causes of jaundice, you can hang them off each place where it might go wrong.
Okay.
But we also have to deal with, why does anyone care if a baby is jaundiced? If we're saying it happens really commonly, it's really normal, why do we test them and why don't we just wait for it to go away?
So could it be indicative of something worse?
That's the first reason why you have to worry about it.
Right.
There was a baby hanging around the nurse's station the other day, and I was like, oh, what a cute little yellow baby. And you can really tell, like when you look at them, you're like, babies are usually cute and like, pink cheeks. Pink is always good. Well perfused. And this one was just sort of like, looked fine.
Just yellow.
Yeah. But you do have to be a bit more cautious, because clearly it's easier to see in some skin types than others.
Yep.
So if you have a Caucasian baby, they go bright yellow. It's really obvious. But in other skin types, it can be actually really quite a bit harder. Mm. And so you actually have to make sure you look, and you some children you only see it on the palms of their hands.
Right, so
and
that's
the yellows of their eyes.
Yeah,
the whites of their eyes. So you have to be really careful that you're just not like, oh, they're not jaundiced, and then you look at their palms and you're like, oh, it looks like they've been face hand painting.
Right.
And sometimes they have.
Yes.
3 days old.
So when jaundice is bad, why is it bad? What is the whole deal with that?
The first thing you said was really correct. So it can be indicative of another disease process going on. So probably the most common one is sepsis. So the child might be unwell.
Okay.
And they will often have other signs. So they might be sleepy and not feeding and have a fever. And then you think, okay, they are jaundiced and they also might have a serious bacterial infection, and then we need to go down that route.
Right.
But, and then they also might have, and I don't want to go too far into this because it's talking about the causes of jaundice, but they might have hemolysis and they might have an underlying process or a metabolic disease causing it.
Okay.
But the main thing, and the reason why we do treat jaundice, even if we think it's physiological jaundice, is a thing called kinicterus.
Kinicterus.
Which is a great word.
It's such a good word.
So it's got the icterus at the end of it.
Yeah. It's a yellow bird.
So what's a kern?
Let's just say it's the brain.
Oh.
I don't know.
It actually possibly... I don't know. I didn't look it up. Hopefully, we could look that up.
So what is kinicterus?
So kinicterus is encephalopathy resulting from deposition of unconjugated bilirubin in the basal ganglia and brainstem nuclei. Wow. Basically, the bilirubin
like you read that or something.
Stains your brain yellow.
Ooh.
Which is bad for it.
Why is it bad for it?
it damages those areas of the brain.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's bad. Sounds the awful. Whole reason that jaundice is bad is because it can get into the brain, so we want to stop that.
Yeah. So, gotcha. And when it gets into the brain, I thought this was really interesting, was the reason why it doesn't like all just go to the brain straight away is because albumin binds it.
Really?
And so once it goes, the level goes so high that the albumin can't bind it anymore, that's when it goes into the brain.
That's so interesting.
And it can cross the brain, blood-brain barrier.
So interesting. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Albumin, I can imagine albumin just like, quickly grab onto the bilirubin. No, no, don't go, don't, no, no, no. And it's like, they've overcome us. We can't hold them back anymore.
Ah. I kind of think of it as like the albumin, and they're like holding all these things, like trying to carry all these molecules, and one falls off and they're like, no.
It's like trying to juggle all of the...
Yeah, and we're all making very amusing hand motions here, which you can't see. I'm sorry. So this kid might come in and you're like, oh my goodness, they're really lethargic and poor feeding. And that could be the first sign of kinicterus. But then they might be irritable. And then you're like, ooh, what's going on here? And then they might have increased muscle tone. And then you're like, ooh, there's something really bad. Ooh. And then they might have seizure.
Oh.
And then you're like, ooh, there's something really, really. And then it can lead to coma and death.
Right.
In the acute phase.
Okay.
So that's the worst in the acute phase. But then it also has lots of long-term consequences. So you can get cerebral palsy. Learning difficulties, and particularly sensorineural deafness.
So, Sarah, I was just jaundiced, from what I understand, just simply physiological jaundice, like, no big deal, just because, you know, I was one of those little babies that my liver was like, whoa, I'm brand new, I'm not ready yet. So could I potentially, if my jaundice was just, like, left, could that have potentially happened to me?
Well, it depends. Were you treated for your jaundice?
I don't remember. I was quite young.
No one's ever told you. But so if you were untreated, then clearly it managed to resolve on its own and that's fine. But quite possibly if it had been untreated and no one had noticed and the levels had gone very high, that could have happened. It is quite uncommon though.
But it's a thing you want to worry about.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And there are some very good nomograms which show you when to treat and when to not. But we'll get into that later.
It's too soon. Love nomograms. All right, go on. Tell us more.
Let's go back to how we think about jaundice.
Okay.
So, and how we measure it. So if you get this baby in front of you, mum's like, oh my God, they look like a pumpkin. You want to know how much of a pumpkin they are. And use the Kramer rule.
Wait, like Seinfeld Kramer?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know Seinfeld.
Oh my God.
All right, so we're going to have to pause this podcast for a second. Dr. Sarah Huskings, although she's a qualified doctor, has never watched Seinfeld.
Which is just insane.
I don't really...
You don't have to like it. You just have to know it exists and know who the main characters are.
There's a guy called Seinfeld.
I've actually been watching comedians in cars getting coffee like all day. And Seinfeld does episodes with like all of them, like Kramer and George and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And so amazing. And it's so sad that you could never appreciate... What about Curb Your Enthusiasm? Anything?
Oh, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
No, I don't know what that is.
Sarah, we are going to have...
It's the clapping and the laughing, the fake laughing.
But it's classic. It's a classic.
Wait, the fake laughing?
It's a classic.
Oh, you know, this would be a really good point if we like put fake laughing in the podcast now. We'll continue. So Kramer scale, Sarah Hoskins probably doesn't know this because she doesn't watch Seinfeld, but it's spelled in a different way to Kramer. It has an E in there. Another E. There's one before the M and after the M.
No, E's. It's K K-R-A-M-E-R.
Oh, so you've got it wrong.
So do I have it wrong?
Yeah, so it is spelled exactly like Kramer from Seinfeld.
I think so.
Okay, regardless, let's move on. What is the Kramer scale?
So this is a not particularly accurate but easy way to look at jaundice. So if the baby's head, because the eyes are almost the first and most obvious thing that go yellow first, so they get icterus, as we talked about. Then if their head is jaundice, that's Kramer rule one.
Okay.
If you go down and their torso is also jaundice, it's Kramer rule two. If you go down and to their knees is jaundice, that's three. To their feet, to their tops of their feet is jaundice, is four. And basically, if the palms of their hands and the bottom of their feet are yellow, that's five, and that's really bad.
Right. Mm. So it's out of five.
So it's out of five. And right. Basically, I think of it as in jaundice starts at the head, and then it goes to the soles of the palms and the soles of feet. And if you see it at the soles and the palms and the soles of feet, you really need to measure their bilirubin on the blood and make sure that they don't need treatment.
Okay.
It's so funny. I'm just imagining Kramer like entering the room and like, you know how he like spazzes out and puts his arms and legs. Everyone's like, oh, yeah. And so you just think hands and feet full of Kramer.
Yeah. So if it gets to that point, you need to do something about it. Gotcha. And it just gives you a good idea if like, if it's only their face and you look at their chest and it's all just, you probably don't need to worry about that.
All right.
Cool.
Then the other way to measure it is that they have a thing called a transcutaneous bilirubin meter, which is really cool. Because they just have a light and they put it on the chest and they test three times.
Sorry,
we just dropped the mic. No, like way in a like we literally dropped the mic. Let's continue.
Yeah. And then it will give you a number which is can be equivalent to the blood. So it means you don't need to do a blood test on a baby.
Oh, that is so much clever. Better.
Yay! So if it's low and more, we kind of went with more than 50 below the bottom of the phototherapy line on the nomogram, which I'm going to tell you about, then we were like, oh good, don't do anything.
All right. So they're just like a little bit jaundiced, you're like, ah, it's chill. So you want to do the Kramer scale.
Yeah, so for this is the like things like the TCB, transcutaneous bilirubin meter, is really useful for like midwives going on home visits.
Right.
And in the special care nursery, because it means that you don't need to stick a baby and do a heel prick test and wait for it to come back and follow up those results. For all of these children, you can just have a light and go boop, boop, and check it. Boop, boop.
That's great.
It is great.
And way less invasive.
Yeah. So, but you can only do that on term infants. So if they're less than 37 weeks, it's not as accurate. And you can only do it. Ooh. I don't know.
Go.
So, and then the gold standard of measuring is, of course, a blood test.
Yeah.
And when you do a blood test, you need to make sure you measure the, ask for the conjugated and the unconjugated or the direct and indirect bilirubin, because it's really important, as we're going to talk about later.
Ooh.
And then you plot it on the nomogram.
It's like building up the suspense. Like, what is this nomogram? Are we going to hear about it? What do we know?
Kind of. So I might talk about it a bit now, because then that helps you. So there are nomograms in the charts, and lots of the hospitals, I think all the hospitals use the same one. And you can get it on your phone too, called a Billy app.
Ooh,
nice.
So Billy app, and then you put in the numbers and the date of birth and everything, and it figures it out for you.
Great. That's amazing.
How good are apps? I can't even imagine being a doctor in the world without apps. It must have been so hard.
Karen and I are a large proponent of like the whole future of medicine being based on apps, and I've told Sarah lots of times, I think hospitals should just be robot run and the doctors just stand on the other side of like the glass and oversee everything.
They probably don't need us to oversee.
They could
just have like queen robot.
There are overlords. Anyway, go on.
Anyway, so there's an app, which is really useful. Basically, that you have two lines that go up from zero age, and you need to make sure when you plot it that you get both the time plot from the time and date of birth at zero, because you want to know if it's within 24 hours. Mm. So that's really important, which I'll tell you in a sec after I finish explaining the nomogram.
Okay.
So the first line is the do they need phototherapy line. So that's one of the treatments. And then the next line, which is above that, is do they need exchange transfusion line, which is the you have really high bilirubin, we really need to do something about this right now line. Vast majority of children are in the phototherapy line. You give them some phototherapy, it comes down. But we're going to talk about phototherapy more later on.
Cool.
She could see me get so excited. I think it's the coolest thing ever. Whoever figured out the blue light.
But you need to know that the most important thing I know about that is the levels of jaundice change on how old the baby is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So a bilirubin of 100 in a neonate who is 1 hour old is really, 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 really high. Right. A bilirubin of 100 in a two-week-old is, or a one-week-old is, it's fine. It doesn't matter.
So it's all about the nomogram, and so that will tell you if it's bad or not.
Mm-hmm. So you always must make sure you plot it, and plot it carefully.
Okay.
It's really important.
Mm.
So how do we actually figure out what caused the jaundice? Is there any possible way we could make this easier to remember?
Well, you gave us a little hint when you said the time over there, so I'm assuming there's something going on there.
Mm.
Just a little piece of investigatory skills on my behalf here.
Sherlock Very clever, Karen. Very clever. So, yeah, Karen is quite correct. Looking at age of onset.
Right.
Jaundice less than 24 hours is always abnormal.
Right.
If you see a yellow baby and it comes out yellow, or in the first few hours of life is yellow, you're like, that is not right.
Okay.
That is very not right.
Mm-mm.
So it means it's usually hemolysis. Vast majority of the time, the cause is hemolysis.
Alrighty.
What is hemolysis and what causes it, I hear you ask? Hemolytic disorders, surprisingly enough. So the most severe one, and the one which thankfully doesn't happen very often anymore, is rhesus hemolytic disease. This is when mum is O negative or a negative blood type, and the baby is a positive blood type, and the mum's antibodies attack the baby's antibodies, and it's all terrible. We now do lots of things during pregnancy and give mum injections so that that doesn't happen, which is fantastic. So it's very rare nowadays.
So would this, for example, like in a clinical context, be someone who hasn't had any antenatal checks, never had any blood tests, comes in, have the baby, you've got no history, you don't know what blood type the mother is, and then the baby, I guess, has jaundice straight away, and you're like, that's, you know, you're thinking
red flag, red flag.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd be definitely very worried about that.
Okay.
The other less severe form of that is ABO incompatibility. So that still happens and is similar with the antibodies, but is less severe.
So just to run that down a little bit more, when we're talking about ABO compatibility, that's when mum's got like an A blood group and then the baby turns out to have a B blood group because it's from the dad or something. So you can't really do anything about that. You can't change mum's blood type, you can't change babies. So mum's going to mount some sort of immune response to the baby's blood cells and they're going to be broken down a little bit faster and you're going to have more bilirubin, so you'll have a yellow baby.
Yeah.
Whereas rhesus, you can know what the mum is and you can know what the baby is. And if they're incompatible, so if there's rhesus incompatibility, you can sometimes give like immunoglobulins that like suck up
so
mum's
you won't,
antibodies.
So you won't ever know that if baby's incompatible or not during pregnancy.
Right.
I mean, you could...
Yeah.
Yeah, generally, you're not going to know that. So we do a lot of prophylaxis.
Yep.
So if mum's... And this is going a bit off topic and I don't know a huge amount of not because I'm not that interested in obstetrics. But from my understanding, if, say, because I'm O negative, so this is going to happen to me, is I will, if I have a miscarriage or if I have bleeding during pregnancy, it's really important for me to go to a hospital and they give me antibodies. And that mops up all of the antibodies that my body is making to possible baby's blood, which means that I don't then have all of those antibodies when I have the next baby.
Right.
Is my understanding of it.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Which I think is really interesting. Mm.
It is really interesting.
Does that also mean they hassle you to donate all the time?
Yes.
Me too.
Are you guys both O-neg?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Freaking Sarah's like surrounding me recently and everybody's the same and I met another Sarah who's like doing pediatrics and anyway.
Sarah's a really common name.
No, I've never met so many Sarahs in my whole life. It's like right now we're in like the Sarah apocalypse.
What a wonderful apocalypse.
I feel so left out.
Anyway, so.
Isn't your middle name Sarah?
No.
Oh.
My sister's is though.
Anyway. O negative means if you are O negative, anybody out there, if you have bleeding during a pregnancy, make sure you go get your anti-D. Really important for your future pregnancies.
Gotcha.
So that's rhesus. And then ABO is less severe form, but still causes hemolysis. Can't do anything about it. Just treat the baby and the jaundice. G6PD is a...
autoimmune condition? Is it autoimmune? It's inherited.
Genetic. Oh, hemolytic disorder.
You're right. Can we delete that? Can we actually... I'm so sorry, Sarah.
So, G6PD is a hemolytic genetic disorder, most commonly found in Mediterranean, Middle East, and African Americans populations.
And they can't have fava beans,
or mothballs.
Yes.
Who both eats of those mothballs?
Things. No. It totally happens because the baby's blanket will be in the cupboard from the last baby, and then they'll have mothballs in the cupboard, and then they wrap the baby up when they go home, and then they get hemolytic jaundice.
Oh my goodness. Oh wait, this is a legit thing.
Yeah.
I thought you meant eating the mothballs. That does make more sense.
But no, if they get wrapped in it and there's been in mothballs, then it can cause the hemolysis.
Oh.
Mm.
Righty-o.
No mothballs.
Mothballs smell bad. I don't understand why anyone has them.
Campfire. Anyway. And it mainly affects boys.
Gotcha.
So G6PD can cause it in the first 24 hours, but it is probably less likely because you generally need a trigger.
Okay.
So you need something to cause the hemolysis.
Mm.
And then in hereditary spherocytosis, it's rare. You see spherotypes on film. Don't worry about it.
Cool. Oh. So when you first told me about this, I thought, wow, that makes so much sense. In the first 24 hours of life, it's going to be all about the blood, the shape of it, and like any deformities, any abnormalities, and the antigens and any antibodies that are attacking it. So it's all about the actual blood breaking down.
Correct.
And as well as sepsis. It's always sepsis.
And the biggest thing that I'm getting from this is less than 24 hours, pathological always.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Always. Then the next thing you need to think about is jaundice. 2 weeks. 2 days to 2 weeks.
Okay.
So this is going to be generally physiological. But you have to rule out the other things and make sure the baby is well with that. So physiological jaundice and breast milk jaundice are by far the two most common things in here. But there are other processes which cause the jaundice. Dehydration, infection, two really common.
Right.
So we often saw, if mum's milk hadn't come down and they'd gone home really early from hospital, the babies would come in and they'd all be really like dried up and really yellow. And you're like, that child needs some milk.
Which makes sense because like if these babies are like processing so much hemoglobin, they're going to have a higher level of bilirubin anyway. Mm-hmm. As soon as you dehydrate them, it's like they have a much lower threshold for turning yellow, whereas we wouldn't turn yellow if we got dehydrated. We
just and it's all about like washing it out of the system and, you know, making sure they're peeing and all that kind of thing as well. So an infection can cause it again. And then hemolysis, because you can still have things like G6PD, which might be triggered when you go home, as we were talking about with the mothball blankets.
Gotcha.
Or they go home and someone gives them some antibiotics for some reason.
Or puts fava beans in their...
mashed up fava beans in their breast milk for some reason. Anyway, and the other one you have to think about is bruising.
Oh.
So if a baby goes home and they have like a large caput from birth trauma, that can be predisposed them to jaundice.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I've seen those babies that they get pulled out with the ventouse, so they've got a suction cup on their head and they've got that big bruise, which is like, fine, it's fine, it's just a bruise. But then if you think about it, that's all broken down red blood cells that are going to go into the bloodstream and like release bilirubin. So they'll be at a higher risk of having jaundice as well.
They will. And there's one called Crigler-Najjar syndrome, which you don't need to know anything about. And I don't know anything about, but I just like the name. Which can also cause
you pronounced it very well.
I don't know if that's how you pronounce it either.
Well, now it is.
We probably have no idea if that is it. We'll trust you on this one, Sarah Hoskins.
Mm. And polycythemia, so which is often in mums who've had diabetic mums. Baby have polycythemic and fat babies, and they can be predisposed to jaundice as well.
Right. Oh,
that's so interesting.
I did not know that.
Because if you think about it, polycythemia have more red blood cells, more likely to have jaundice.
That makes
and
sense.
Having diabetes means there's heaps of sugar, so you're going to be a fat baby and like you've got lots of red blood cells because you're just like full up, you know? It's too much. Too much of a good time in the womb.
Yeah, too much sugar. Too much sugar. Too many Tim Tams. So then the next way to think about jaundice is prolonged jaundice. So more than 2 weeks is prolonged jaundice. So, and then this is when you have to really think about conjugated and unconjugated.
Just to clarify, does this mean it starts after a two-week period or it lasts for more than 2 weeks?
Lasts longer than 2 weeks.
Gotcha.
Mm. So you've already ruled out everything else, I guess.
So it can start after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So like again, G6PD, they get triggered after 2 weeks and then they get... But then you would be very suspicious that this was not physiological breast milk jaundice. So physiological breast milk jaundice should start and then just gradually get worse, and physiological jaundice will get kind of better by 5 days, and breast milk jaundice can actually last for up to like 6 weeks. But it should be kind of getting better, and it should have been there from the start. It shouldn't just appear.
Okay.
That would be abnormal. So greater than 2 weeks, the causes are physiological breast milk jaundice, infection, as always, hypothyroidism.
Random.
But you often...
Random.
Mm. So hopefully your child has been born in a hospital and has had their GO3 your prick test, which
Guthrie?
Guthrie?
I have no idea.
Guthrie that just sounds more Aussie to me. I thought
newborn screening test. And we'll have found out that they have hypothyroidism, but often in the babies who have prolonged jaundice, we might do send off a set of TFTs to make sure. Hemolytic anemia can still cause it. And also, like, if they have a high, like, obstruction of some sort, a high gut obstruction.
That's so interesting, that gut obstruction thing, because I was talking about it with some students, and I'd never thought of it that in that unconjugated and conjugated breakdown way. So, like, if you have hemolysis, it's going to be unconjugated bilirubin because it's before it's gone through the liver, whereas if you have some weird congenital abnormality where, like, you've got that, like, cholecystocytic cyst or biliary atresia where your gallbladder and all of the ducts are, like, missing, like, some crazy mess, something like that, then your liver's still working and it's conjugating the bilirubin, but it just it's not getting out. So you'll have that buildup of conjugated bilirubin.
Yeah, exactly. Because if it's unconjugated, it's before the liver. And if it's conjugated, it's already gone through the liver, which is totally the way I thought I would think about it too. So that's unconjugated. And then conjugated is, as Sarah said, biliary atresia and cholecystocytic cysts or neonatal hepatitis also.
Oh.
So you have to think of a few different causes there.
Okay.
But the main one is biliary atresia. Always think about
And so biliatresia will have conjugated bilirubin.
Yes, will be high.
Will be high.
Alrighty.
As a like proportion. And there's a certain proportion you can do, but don't worry about it. So I'd like to just tell you a bit more about biliatresia because it's really interesting and really cool. And I got asked about it on an OSCE in fourth year.
Oh, fancy.
So they're biliary obstruction, two main causes, as we said. And how to tell the difference was totally a question in one of my exams. In biliary atresia, you do an ultrasound after you find out that they've got conjugated hyperbilirubinemia.
Okay.
And it might be normal. Or you might not see a gall. Or you just might not visualize a gallbladder, and that doesn't mean much. But in a cholecystocytic cyst, they will have a dilated common bile duct. So cholecystocytic cyst equals dilated common bile duct.
Okay.
And then if so, anyone asks you on an exam, and in the question they have a dilated common bile duct, you can be like, bang, cholecystocytic cyst, not biliary atresia. Yes.
Which makes sense, because if you think of like a cyst is like a big swollen something, and the common bile duct, cholecystocytic kind of means gallbladder, bile duct, it all fits together.
Yeah, whereas biliary atresia is atresic. You can't see them because they aren't there.
Oh, that totally makes sense.
Exactly.
So the ultrasound's the way to differentiate.
Yes, but you can't. If it's normal or you can't see anything, they can still have biliary atresia. And then they do other things and just talk to the gastroenterologists and the surgeons.
refer.
And the other thing to note is biliary atresia. The reason why we want to find it out so early is because they have a much better outcome from their operation, which they can get, which is called a Kasai procedure, than if it's delayed. So if you do it earlier, they have a better outcome than if it's delayed. That's why we want to find it early.
Kasai.
Kasai is a great word as well. Everything to do with the liver is amazing words.
They're just good words.
It's just amazing, and I love it.
And then if the Kasai procedure fails, they get a liver transplant.
It almost sounds like Kawasaki. Sorry, that's just confusing.
Why would you say that?
Do you know why that is, Sarah? Because both Kawasaki's and biliary atresia are very common in Japan.
Oh.
Wow. Mind blown.
I'm actually just impressed you had an actual answer for that.
Yeah. That's so good.
Anyway, so if the Kasai procedure, I actually have a number here for you, is performed before age 60 days, it's 80% successful. And then after that, it goes down and down and down and down.
So before 80 days.
80 days, yeah.
Cool. So like 2.5 months.
Yeah.
Nice.
Hopefully someone has noticed that they look like a pumpkin at 2.5 months and has done. But then they have to come in and they have to have all these tests.
Yeah.
And it's not like they come into the GP and they get their conjugated hyperbilirubinemia found out and then the next day they get their operation.
They would if they were in a robot hospital.
Maybe it might be pretty quick though. I reckon they come in pretty quick. Anyway.
So how do we treat jaundice?
Aha. Management of jaundice.
In particular, the phototherapy.
No. We're going to start from the start.
So first thing is you need to treat
the cause before you treat the jaundice.
Okay.
This is how you know that she's a doctor because she thinks like this.
Two ways you've got to think about this. So the first is treat the cause. So do they have an infection? Do they need antibiotics? Are they dehydrated? Do they need fluids? You know, think about why is this happening and then treat the cause first. And often if a child comes in jaundiced and flat and unwell looking, they will just get antibiotics because we just presume infection, especially if they've had a fever, it's kind of a bit of a no-brainer.
Gotcha.
And often if they've dehydrated, then they need top-ups and bottle feeds and we help mum with her lactation consultants and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Cool. Then the next thing is phototherapy.
Woo! Give me that UV, UVB, blue light, UVB.
I heard that one time someone had a jaundiced baby and then they were next to the window and they found that the babies that were next to the window did better than the babies not next to the window, and that's how they discovered it works. Is that true?
I don't know.
That sounds so cool.
I know.
The current guideline is to not stick your child next to the window because they get skin sunburn and skin cancer.
Well, yeah, that's fair.
That's fair.
But like, cool story.
It is a cool story. And I love the fact when it converts, they get this awesome tan. Literally, they look really brown.
So,
and tans are bad. Skin cells and trauma.
Unless you need blue light phototherapy.
And so the phototherapy specifically is wavelength of 450 nanometers.
450.
And blue-green, as Sarah said. Blue-green. So what it does is it converts the bilirubin that is in the skin and helps break it down so that you can then excrete it.
So to anyone who hasn't ever seen this before, you're basically looking at a baby who's in this tiny little box and the box is like illuminated with all this light. It's like blue-green light, and that's the phototherapy. They're just like chilling out in a box and it's helping them. It's crazy.
And it's non-invasive and it's amazing. And it turns the bilirubin into something that's water soluble so that it can be absorbed and excreted, which is just like, how did you figure that out?
And interestingly, once they've had phototherapy, you can't use the transcutaneous bilirubin neater because you get better breakdown at the skin than you do on the inside. And so their bilirubin might be really high on the inside, but because you've broken down all the stuff with the skin, it's not accurate anymore.
So then you've got to do the blood test to test
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Gotcha.
Ah, interesting.
Mm. I thought I was like, oh, that's interesting.
That is good to know.
So the interesting thing is if you have a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, when you get this, like rash and bronze discoloration. But you should probably know that before they went in, if it was unconjugated or conjugated. But I thought that was cool.
That is kind of interesting.
So if you didn't happen to know it and they got this weird rash and they were turned like a nice like bronze, like a Bondi babe, then you're like, oh.
Like a statue.
They might have conjugated. Yeah. And there's some complications. So you need to watch out for dehydration because they're actually under lights all the time and you need to protect their eyes.
They get to wear those cool sunglasses.
Just cool, baby.
So I think Sarah mentioned before, in recess and ABO incompatibility, give the baby IVIG. Which works really well. And then the ultimate therapy for jaundice is exchange transfusion. So blood goes in one side and comes out the other.
Exchange transfusion is just so cool. It's like you take out, this is the first time I heard the word aliquot since I finished chemistry. You're taking out like 20 mils of the baby's blood and then replacing it with 20 mils because you can't just like run all this blood in and out at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you just like take out a little bit, put in a little bit more.
One of my pediatric registrar friends did this while she was in a NICU, and it's very like resource intensive because you need a registrar and a fellow like sitting there for 5 or 6 hours just doing that.
Yeah.
And so it's very, you're like, oh my God, this is so cool. I get to be in exchange transfusion.
And then it's
and 8 hours later, less cool.
Blood goes in, blood comes out. So you probably want to hope that the lights work and other things work, because that's pretty intense.
And you can use more light. So like there's single light phototherapy, there's triple light phototherapy. Right, so you can try
more
really
lights, more lights.
Really lots of lights. And even if they're on the very borderline, we'll often give them lots of lights to try and get it down. And then you measure it again to see if it's coming down. If it's coming down, perfect. If it's going up, then you're like, oh, I need to do something about this. Because I don't want them to get connectorous, which is bad. Yellow staining in your brain.
Bad.
Bad.
That does sound
looks
bad.
Cool. Feels bad. So you just like take out the bad blood that has too much bilirubin or like weird antibodies in it, and replace it with nice fresh blood that me and Sarah donate every month,
which
every
is hopefully being cross-matched.
Which is definitely being cross-matched.
Yes. So that is basically neonatal jaundice in a nutshell.
That's fantastic. I think we should like summarize a couple of really important points, mostly for my sake. So less than 24 hours, pathological until proven otherwise. So you are going to worry about these babies. And you can kind of divide it up into less than 24 hours, 2 days to 14 days, and then more than 2-week period. And the thing you're always worried about is connectoris if it goes on for too long or too high. Mm-hmm. That was very informative.
Don't forget infection.
And, oh, yeah. Infection. Mm-hmm. Just give them antibiotics. Good. Pump them full.
But don't... Not if they're well, don't.
No, but unless they're well, yeah. Then don't.
Then it's physiological and they don't need treatment and you can reassure.
Sarah, reassure.
Before you leave us on this beautiful day, we were wondering if you could leave us with a study hack. So anything that has helped you throughout your time in, you know, actually being a real life doctor.
Yeah, because you're a fancy ass doctor.
Fancy.
I was thinking about this today, about what I would bring and what wisdom I would impart on new medical students.
Older and wiser.
And I thought one of the things I was like, oh, how can I make my job easier? So, and I was thinking about that. And I think the best thing that you can do as a medical student, especially to help out your harangued, overworked resident, is to ask questions, is the first thing. So if you have a question about something, totally ask, because we might not think that it's important and might not remember to teach you, but if you ask me about it, I will teach you about it because it's really important. And the second thing is, if you notice you're in a really special position in hospitals because you aren't generally, except for Sarah, who was my resident, overworked because I overworked her. Oops. But generally aren't quite so busy trying to think of everything. So if you notice that something is wrong, if you notice that something is not right and you're not sure about it, let someone know, because you might be the only person who notices it and you can save people's lives that way.
Ooh,
and make a difference.
Wow. That bombshell.
That's quite empowering, actually.
Mm.
And it's so true. As in, I remember, like, this is the first... Well, probably last year was the first year that I actually thought that asking questions and speaking up is a really big part of being a medical student. And they don't teach you when they're pounding you down with like all these lectures about absolutely every topic under the sun. There's not one lecture that's like, ask questions if you're confused, look it up, talk to the nurses about it, or just, you know, bring it up and don't feel scared about it because that's your role. And
yeah.
It's so true.
100%. And totally on the asking question things, well, I just asked you a whole lot of questions and then somehow we just got Sarah to teach us every single week about pediatrics. So it totally worked. And not everyone's keen to teach, but sometimes people are super keen to teach, and the best way to learn is on the job.
Yeah, and that's why you're there. That's the whole idea. You're there for 3 years is to learn things. We don't just put you there just to do our discharge summaries. We want you to learn things as well, and you're not getting paid. So the only thing you're getting paid in is learning time. So
can you imagine it's all the deep, dark plot to get everyone to do a discharge summary? So
Sarah feels so bad about how many discharge summaries I did. It's okay. I only did because I love you, love.
Love you, dub.
And I got you here, and I made you do a podcast.
Yes. So happy this happened. Thank you so much for being on this podcast. This is like the best thing ever. It is an honor and a privilege.
Thanks, guys. I'm so looking forward to when you're super famous and have millions of viewers and be like, I was on that podcast.
What do you mean?
No,
you're
just
super famous.
You jinxed. No, you jinxed.
More super famous. More super famous.
Well, to become super famous, we need you guys to please send us questions.
Yes.
Send us voicemails.
Topics.
Check us out on Facebook. We're at Humorous Hacks. On the Twitter, at Humorous Hacks. And our Gmail account, humoroushacks@gmail.com.
Leave us a comment on iTunes and we will literally choose a topic based on what you tell us to. We're so keen.
Yeah. Also, we got our first negative iTunes review, which I think is a marker of success.
I know. It's like, we were so excited. We're like, yes. People are listening to us.
Any people who don't love us are listening to us. Yes.
What did they say? They said that we went off topic a lot, which incidentally is one of our key aims. Is to just really talk about whatever we want to talk about. So we have done that well. Thanks. Thanks, Patrick Lewis. And we'll leave you with don't stress.
Yeah, don't stress.
Don't stress.
Love ya.
Humorous Hacks. It's a medical podcast. We're gonna teach you. We're gonna teach you things.